Speaking on this program is Brother Charles Pledge.
We all believe what we want to believe. Does that statement shock you? Are you surprised? What of all those people who are misinformed and believe something terribly harmful to them? They still believe what they want to believe. Some may choose to want to believe something based upon their feelings or some other subjective basis. Others choose to believe only that for which the evidence warrants believing. But in each case, we all believe what we want to believe, even if believing it produces feelings we do not want. With that in view, let's begin an examination of a few simple reasons for believing that there is an almighty personal God who is the absolute supreme creator and ruler of this universe in which we live. We all face a very simple choice. The choice is whether we believe in God as presented in the Bible or whether we choose to not believe in God as presented in the Bible. Belief or unbelief is the simple choice. Unbelief may exist in many forms. It might be called atheism, humanism, agnosticism, materialism, or perhaps by other terms. Regardless of how one may refer to unbelief, though, it is still unbelief. Although there are many reasons for people rejecting the compelling evidences to believe in a personal supreme God, we want to call your attention to a few that exist right here in the United States of America. Reason number one for disbelief, perhaps at the root of most unbelief in our society, is the increasing love for and dependency upon the material. Ours may be one of the most materialistically dependent societies ever. Resistance to materialism grows weaker with every decade, and consequently, multitudes are turning their backs upon compelling evidences to believe. Reason number two, false philosophies which diametrically oppose faith abound more than ever before. There was a time when people had to go to a faraway university or hire a private tutor to be introduced to humanistic philosophies that oppose the most basic reasons to believe in God. However, today, television and radio, magazines, books, newspapers, and other mass media blatantly exalt all that opposes God. Faith is held up for ridicule by those who humanistic philosophies, which once were found only in a few universities of the world and a very few books. Where once the few were battered by such, now the masses are held captive as these media tools captivate and bring into captivity the untrained and gullible minds of the multitudes. Third, many educational influences contribute directly to unbelief. Humanistic subjectivity has replaced objectivity in science departments and other related disciplines. Humanistic standards have captured the disciplines of sociology, psychology, and related fields. Humanist revisionists have butchered the disciplines of history until students no longer know what happened in the past and consequently are bound to repeat the same mistake of other societies. Overall, unbelief is glorified in most educational circles, and faith in God and Christ ridiculed at the same time. Students become hardened and go out to become parents, teachers, politicians, and other leaders who hold aloft the same mistakes which overwhelm them in school. A fourth reason for so much unbelief in our society is ignorance of the Word of God and failure to distinguish between Christianity and the quasi-Christian religions that sprang up in the world. All this contributes to an ever-growing darkness of unbelief. Many, seeing and knowing only the false religions, the quasi-Christians, and being repulsed by their mercenary hedonistic lives, have concluded that all religions are alike and all are produced by the same word, the Bible. But not all are produced by the Bible. The pretenders of the world, the quasi-Christianity, that is, that which only appears to be Christianity, came not from the New Testament, but from human dogmas. False religions come from the additions and the subtractions people make as they interpret the Bible, or as they apply their faulty beliefs and imaginations and superstitions to religion. Consequently, many people are completely hardened against believing in God, in Christ, and in the Bible. A fifth reason for so much unbelief existing, the sin problem continues to add unbelief in this world. Once the sinful way is accepted as an acceptable or alternative lifestyle, and religious people defend sinful practices and beliefs, unbelievers will harden in their unbelief, and new unbelievers will be produced. The man hardened in sin is hostile toward God and will go out of the way to harm God or those who believe in God, if possible. We read in Colossians chapter 1, verse 21, "And you that were sometime alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled." Sin, accepted in the heart, will cause the sinner to be the enemy of God. Closely related to the last point is the fact that some are determined to live without God and want to cause others to be the same. That's reason number 6 for so much unbelief in our society. Some are determined to live without God, and they're going to try everything within their power to cause others to be the same. Once one is determined to live without God, that one will grasp any excuse to continue. Paul wrote in Romans 1, verse 28, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient." Now these people who examined God and decided he wasn't worthy to remain in their thoughts take pleasure in those who do the same things. We read in Romans chapter 1, verse 32, "Who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them." These are always trying to get others to join them in their way of living, and so often they are successful. There are many other reasons why unbelief is becoming more prevalent, but these are among the most common ones. No life remains untouched by one or more of these causes of unbelief. Each of us need to answer the question as it applies to us, why do I disbelieve? Or, on the other hand, why do I believe? Remember, the answer is very simple. Very simple. I believe what I believe because that is what I want to believe. More to the point, what are reasons are the reasons which compel me to believe what I do believe? What makes me want to believe as I believe? If you do not believe in God, which of the reasons for disbelieving compel you to disbelieve? On the other hand, what are some compelling reasons why I should believe in God? Why I ought to want to believe in God as the personal supreme creator of the universe? Number one, belief in God is the only reasonable choice and therefore the only right choice. Perhaps this is not the way we should begin if we listen to pleasant society or political correctness advocates. However, we need to be upfront with ourselves and others in all things, regardless of whether it's politically correct or incorrect. There is a law of thought called the law of rationality. This law of rationality is one we accept in principle every day in making all of our choices. The law of rationality says, in effect, and hear it carefully, here it is, we ought to draw only conclusions that are warranted by adequate evidence. In other words, we ought to only believe what the evidence is sufficient to support. The other side of this law says, we ought to reject every conclusion that is not supported by adequate evidence. We all use this law daily without thinking of the formal construction of it. For example, driving down the street, we see the light changing from green to yellow. We are a good 10 seconds from the intersection, so we began to slow down for a stop. Why? Because the driver's manual says yellow means clear the intersection, not rush to beat the red light. Yellow is caution. Our thoughts automatically accept the evidence that says we can't make it through the intersection before the light becomes red, so we prepare to stop. Or we go to the grocery store to buy some apples. A favorite friend of ours owns this store and manages it. We begin picking our apples and feel one that is soft and smelly, and the color is changed from a bright red to a dull brown almost all over. Do we have to stand there to think through this matter before making a choice of whether to buy the apple or lay it aside? No. Why? Because the evidence warrants the conclusion that something is wrong with the apple and it won't be edible. What choice do we make about buying the apple? Is the choice based upon subjective feeling that maybe this apple will be edible because, after all, a friend owns the store? Or is the choice based upon the evidence? One is a rational choice, the other is irrational. Which choice would you make? We prepare to go to work one morning. We look out the window to see what the weather is like or appears to be like. We see bright sunshine and not a twig is stirring. We turn on the radio and the weatherman says it's 20 below zero and the temperature is expected to drop lower. The forecast is for a blizzard to arrive within the next 2 or 3 hours. Warnings are issued to stay off the road after the next 1 hour. Do we make a decision to put on summer clothing and leave without a coat because of the appearance we perceive through our window? Or do we take into consideration all the evidence available before we leave for work? Our choice would be based upon appearances, the other upon evidences. One would require subjective interpretation, the other an objective conclusion. But I tell you, in that case and in all the others, we're going to believe what we want to believe in the case. It's a matter of choosing what is going to form our beliefs. What's going to be the basis for our beliefs that cause us to want to believe what we believe? The application of this to believing in God is very simple. A plain statement is made in Romans chapter 1, verse 20. Paul said, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." The fact that those who disbelieve are without excuse is proof positive that belief in God is the only reasonable way. It's the only rational way. All else demands an irrational subjective conclusion. The objective evidence all points to the existence of God. Now, let's examine five simple arguments. Very briefly, of course, but at least we want to be introduced to them. These arguments are evidences which must be investigated. In a collection, they form a reasonable basis for believing in God, and to reject these five arguments would be unreasonable, therefore irrational, therefore wrong morally. Reason number one, argument number one. The existence of matter demands prior existence of intelligence. The universe is material in nature. It is scientifically demonstrable that matter is not eternal. Just take the law of entropy. The law of entropy, sometimes called the second law of thermodynamics, is that law of the universe that governs the exchange of heat between bodies in this universe. Heat goes from the warmer to the cooler body. And this is what's called the law of entropy. That means death or dying, dead. And so what it means is that when all of the heat has been exchanged and all the bodies become uniform temperatures, so there is no warmer and there is no cooler bodies, but all bodies have achieved uniform temperature, there will not be any heat exchange. Therefore, everything will die, that is, be dead. There will be no energy because it's the exchange of heat that creates that energy. So there'll be no energy because there'll be no heat exchange, and everything will just come to a death standstill. Does that sound scary? Well, that's just the way matter is. You can't help it. The law that one of the laws that governs the universe says that matter cannot be eternal. It had to be created. Now, another law that we operate by on this earth is the law of sterility. Nothing can come where nothing is. Pasteur proved this when he demonstrated sterility. Sterilize a test tube and keep it sterile, and nothing will ever grow in that tube. Therefore, if there was nothing at one time, then there will always be nothing. Because matter cannot be eternal, remember the law of entropy, then matter must have had a beginning. Since matter did not exist, and something can never come from nothing, then non-matter, intelligence, had to exist eternally. The evidence is compelling that the eternal intelligence that was prior to matter is God. And God is not merely intelligence, but all intelligence comes from God. The second argument is what we call the causal argument. The causal argument is the argument that says every effect must have an adequate cause. Things don't just happen. I don't care what the bumper stickers say. Things don't just happen. Any scientist, it doesn't matter who he would be, whether the most famous of the world or the most unknown, any scientist that suddenly proclaimed that things just happen with no adequate cause would be laughed out of the scientific community. Why? Perhaps the most pervasive and basic principle of science is the law of causality, or the causal law. Every effect must have an adequate cause. If a scientist does not believe this, he has no compelling reason to research anything. If there is no adequate cause for every effect, then things just happen and there's nothing we can do about it. Everything is just operable by blind chance, by accident. The universe exists. There had to be an adequate cause to produce such a massive effect. Because matter cannot be eternal, matter had to have a beginning. Because every part of the universe is a dependent part, the universe as a whole is a dependent universe. Upon what, or more correctly, upon whom, is the universe dependent? All the answers to these questions, every single one of them, demands God. God is the only reasonable solution to the question. The first round of evidences compel a rejection of materialism and an acceptance of supreme intelligence as the reason for our existence. The third argument is the argument of design. This is the argument that says all continuing design must have a designer. Water may erode the rock and create a lovely design. That design, however, cannot perpetuate itself. It cannot reproduce itself for another rock. But one concludes the rock is a non-life entity or being. It's unfair to use that as an analogy. No, no, much of the universe is composed of non-living matter. And since evolution demands accident and that the material is the in effect eternal, regardless of how they may deny the that argument or that statement, the actual ultimate conclusion of the argument demands the eternality of matter. And so you can't reject this illustration. All existence may be divided into two groups, life and non-life forms. There is no, and I repeat, there is no transition form between these groups. There never has been a transition, nor will there ever be a transition form between the life form and the non-life form of existence. It is logically, therefore intelligently, impossible. It is also materially impossible, since matter cannot reproduce itself in any form. And when life ceases to be life, it is non-life. When we look at a beautiful building, we never ask, did someone design this building? What if you went around looking at buildings and said to your friends, did someone design this? We know, without asking, that someone had to design that building. We always ask, who designed this? Not, was it designed? The Bible is very clear on this axiomatic matter. And it is an axiom. It is a truth so thoroughgoing and so pervasive that all people accept it as true. We read in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4, for every house is builded by some man. You see, every house has a design. But he that built all things is God. God is the creator of this universe. All the design around us is the result of God's intelligence. There can be no equivocation here. Every house is built or designed by some man. Why? Because it has a design which can be duplicated. Applied to the universe, this is a simple yet unanswerable argument. Every living thing, from a submicroscopic virus to the largest living thing, has an identifiable design that sets that particular living thing apart from every other living thing in the universe. This is called design. That design remains in that being by propagation, so long as the species continues to beget itself apart from any other species, that causes a blending or blurring of design. But if that happens, and a new species is introduced or comes into being, that species can be identified by its own design, which is propagated by reproduction. If anyone can believe all existing design is merely the result of blind accident or chance, that person can believe anything. The Bible affirms that God built all things. Intelligence is required to explain the presence of all design, most of which design man cannot even begin to understand. The unbeliever must declare that man is the supreme being in the universe. But think about it. Man cannot even begin to understand all the design around him, which was produced by intelligence. Now, this is pretty strong evidence to compel one to believe a supreme being, and that's God, is responsible for all the intelligent, continuing design in the universe. Because we touched on the principle of the moral law in the first study in this series, we'll not develop this extensively. By moral, we mean that ability to know the difference, to be able to choose between right and wrong conduct. Moral judgment is that faculty possessed on earth only by man. This faculty enables man among all mortals to make choices based solely upon an educated moral judgment faculty that knows there is a morally right and morally wrong action. Men may disagree between or over what is right and what is wrong. But this emphasizes the principle that man recognizes there is a right and a wrong. The whole universe is so integrated with man's moral nature that man is forced to make moral choices. This is further evidence that man was created in an intelligent fashion for the purpose of growing in moral nature so long as he remained rationally responsible. Since like produces like, the moral could not evolve from the non-moral. The moral nature in man must have come from a moral source. That's God. The adaptation of the universe and man to each other indicates a wise moral design, a design explainable only on the basis of supreme unlimited intelligence and power. Morality can only be attributed to a rational moral person. Therefore, the source of morality must be a rational person, God. Man, a moral being, is admitted by all to be a mortal being, that is, one who had a beginning. Where did his beginning come from? God. Moral values exist. There is no rational explanation for moral values apart from God Almighty. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 7, a passage which becomes even more significant, we read, "And God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the earth, or of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Fifth argument, the evidence from the plant and animal kingdoms, and time forbids that we develop this fully, but I want to call your attention quickly to a few things. Four things are paramount in the plant kingdom. One, orderliness. Two, complexity. Three, beauty. And four, inheritance. In the animal kingdom, there are at least three predominant factors. Number one, instinct of survival. Number two, complexity. And number three, inheritance. Every orderly, complex, continuing design must have an intelligent designer. Who would claim that the simple watch worn by so many just happened by blind chance? Why then argue that the plant and animal kingdoms observable around us, so complex and so orderly, just happened? Time forbids more than just a mention of the obligate relationships. The yucca moth and the yucca plant is one of a multitude of these relationships. Hundreds exist. The yucca plant is a plant that abounds in the southwest and even in the high plains and other places. It is propagated through the distribution of its pollen in only one way by one insect, the yucca moth. The yucca moth has for its sole food source the yucca plant. Apart from each other, they both would die. They depend upon each other. That's why they're called obligate relationship. There was no time for these to evolve. It demanded a creation. That's the only way you can explain the existence of obligate relationship, and that is by creation. There are other plants, other animals, insects. But we're back to our simple choice. We either believe or we disbelieve. We all believe what we want to believe. It reduces then to the question, do I really want to believe that which the evidence overwhelmingly supports, or do I choose to believe a conclusion based upon lack of evidence and demanding more credulity than almost anything that can be surmised? The choice must be made by every person sooner or later. Our next study will deal with even more compelling reasons to believe in God. We hope you've enjoyed and learned from this study together. We most sincerely want only that which is in your best interest. It is with that in view that we urge you to continue your next study, which will be Jesus of Nazareth, Son of God. Thank you so much for taking your time in this study.